From the Center for Racial Equity in Education, this is Deep Rooted, a brief history of race and education in North Carolina, written by Ethan Roy and James E. Ford. Deep Rooted is a historical companion piece to Creed's Erasing Inequities Report. You can access both reports at our website, creed-nc.org. And now, episode two. Post-war progress, presidential reconstruction. In 1865, in the years that followed, freed people in the South began constructing their new lives and communities. Like Freedom Hill, later Princeville, enabled by emancipation, one of the first things they did was to build schools. In many areas, freed people organized to pay for school buildings, supplies, and teachers. The Raleigh publication, Journal of Freedom, reported in October 1865, "The freed man has got a disease for learning. It is a mania within him." The following year, delegates at the Freedmen's Convention in Raleigh created a constitution for the Freedmen's Educational Association of North Carolina to help improve African-American education in the state. Observations from Northern teachers in North Carolina under organizations such as the AMA and the Freedmen's Bureau confirmed this quote-unquote mania. Harriet Pike, a white woman teaching blacks in Wake County, observed, "Old and young are very eager to learn. Very often, mothers in the midst of their children learn from them what they had been taught that day." Moreover, Pike observed, "Men and boys who have to work in the cotton fields from sunrise till dark, sitting under a tree studying a primer during the few moments of rest they are allowed after dinner." Along with the efforts of freed people themselves, the Freedmen's Bureau and organizations such as the AMA provided crucial aid to black education in the South during the early months of Reconstruction. Education was one of the main avenues taken by the Bureau to reform Southern society, and they had much to work with already. Schoolhouses built by freed people dotted North Carolina. Those, along with financial aid and teachers provided by the AMA, were corralled by the Freedmen's Bureau to create a, quote-unquote, loosely organized, if still vulnerable, educational network. During the period of Reconstruction, North Carolina was embroiled in fierce political conflict between white Democrats, determined to hold on to the pre-Civil War racial hierarchy, and the biracial Republican Party championing racial progress. Using violence to maintain control, white Democrats often resorted to violence and intimidation directed towards freed people. This racially motivated political violence was so endemic throughout the South that the Republican-controlled Congress passed the Enforcement Acts in 1870 through 71 to try to persecute white terrorist organizations. Whites burned down 4 schoolhouses in early 1866 and 2 more the following year. Also in 1866, 2 black men in Duplin County were forced to close their school after whites threatened to burn it to the ground. During the same time period, a northern teacher named Thomas Barton was dragged for miles by a white mob who called him a goddamn Yankee nigger school teacher and said, "The niggers were bad enough before you came, but since you've been teaching them, they know too much and are a damn sight worse." Other whites, mostly elites, tolerated black education to an extent, believing, quote-unquote, instruction for blacks should be aimed at creating a peaceful, hard-working black population which knew its proper place in Southern society. Upper-class whites realized a meanly educated black workforce could be good for business, but felt over-education of freed people might spur destruction of the Southern racial hierarchy. Northern teachers were a main target of this fear. Said Raleigh Sentinel, "Northern teachers were dangerous because of their almost universal disposition to mingle upon terms of social equality with the blacks, and their teaching blacks ideals intensely hostile to the peace and harmony of the races. The General Assembly abolished the universal school system created for whites before the war. The majority of the General Assembly stated the decision was simply a fiscal necessity, but the Union County State Senator, D.A. Covington, pointed to another reason. White North Carolinians feared the Freedmen's Bureau might force colored children into the schools, he said, to which our people would never consent. Still, the efforts of freed people and various agencies increased the number of schools for African Americans from 100 in December 1865 to 156 in March 1867. Likewise, the number of teachers rose from 132 to 173, while the number of pupils rose from 8,500 to 13,039. Progress would continue thanks largely to the efforts of freed people, but violence from native whites lay on the horizon. Radical Reconstruction, a new dawn for black education? Congress passed the Military Reconstruction Act in 1867, ushering in a new era of Reconstruction in the South. North Carolina was required to draft a new constitution and adopt the 14th Amendment, giving black men the right to vote. The Progressive Republican Party seized political control of the state in 1867. The year before a new constitutional convention would be held. The Freedmen's Bureau Superintendent of Education, F.A. Fisk, was sure that education would one day extend across the ballot for black men, eventually allowing them to exert political and economic power to become first-class citizens. For a brief historic moment, Fisk's prediction appeared to be a possibility. A state constitutional convention in 1868 proved to be a revolutionary moment for public education in North Carolina. Officially adopting black education and creating a new universal public school system for blacks and whites to operate at least 4 months out of the year. A state superintendent would preside over the school system, while a state tax for schools would fund it. The first superintendent was Massachusetts native, Reverend Samuel Stanford Ashley, who came to North Carolina with the AMA in 1865 and remained an ardent supporter of the education of freed people until his departure in 1871. While many white North Carolinians accepted black education to some degree, whites generally feared the intentions of Northern teachers and wanted to control the curriculum in order to, as a Fayetteville newspaper put it, develop in him a useful and profitable laborer. The 1868 convention bypassed whites' perceived threat of integrated schools using vague language. A resolution for segregated schools passed but failed to make it into the final draft. White backlash soon broke out across North Carolina. The Wilmington Daily Journal proclaimed, "Think of it, you men of families. You may die soon. After you are gone, your children may be forced to go to school with Negroes." Equal education threatened social order. Whites and blacks alike knew the connection between education and the right to vote and participate in civil life. Thus, giving suffrage to black men and educating the black children was bad enough. But the conservative Wilmington Daily Journal concluded that in the new state constitution, African Americans could not be, quote-unquote, excluded from occupying any place in a public church, public school, public hotel, or assemblage he or she may claim under the vital principle of the Constitution, the right to intermarry with a white person. To conservative whites, black education led down a slippery slope, one they would not go down without a fight. By 1869, As the Ku Klux Klan infiltrated North Carolina, racial violence targeting black education exploded. White teachers were beaten and threatened. Freed people grew warier of sending their children to school, especially at night. That year, Alamance and Orange counties alone saw 55 whippings, 3 hangings, 1 drowning, 1 shooting, 3 houses shot into, and 2 houses torn down. Later, a congressional investigation committee found 260 Klan visitations had occurred in 20 North Carolina counties by mid-1870. In this violent context, the state lost 49 schools, 511 teachers, and 1,683 students from the peak of 1868 to 69 school term to the peak of the following year. Rise of the Democrats and the advent of Jim Crow. In 1870, the conservative Democrats gained control of the North Carolina legislature and forced Superintendent Ashley out. His replacement, Alexander McIver, did not believe in integrated schools, nor did he seem to care about African American education in general. Democrats immediately adopted an amendment mandating segregated schools and enacted legislation that transferred public school funding from a state tax to a county tax, crushing the previous Republican system. The efforts of white supremacy within the Democratic Party were gaining steam. School segregation was a topic of heated debate during the Constitutional Convention of 1875. White Republicans abandoned African American legislators in the State General Assembly, leaving them no choice but to acquiesce in order to preserve the rights they had. White Republicans pushed instead for mutuality, essentially arguing that African Americans should have control over their communities separate from whites. Mutuality later morphed into a Democratic argument for segregation. Voters ratified the new state constitution in 1876, legally mandating segregated schools. In the early to mid-1880s, the education system in North Carolina remained ineffective for both African Americans and poor whites. Nearly half the state's population was illiterate. Racial and class conflict bred a general animosity towards education, especially publicly funded education. Whites in particular did not want their taxes to help fund black education, feeling, as the Greenville Eastern Reflector wrote in 1887, that educating blacks ruined a field hand. Sharecropping had in effect replaced slavery and guaranteed a reliable black labor force, but education could threaten everything. In 1881, the federal government began offering aid to states that met certain requirements under the Blair Bill, which, quote-unquote, called for a direct appropriation from the National Treasury to be distributed to the states based on illiteracy. The Republican-controlled state Senate championed a series of Blair's bills over the next decade, but the Democratic-controlled House blocked their efforts every time. While Democrats did support the idea of federal aid for education, they did not believe the federal government should place requirements on that aid, especially tax increases. The most ardent supporters of federal aid for education were African American legislators and educators. For example, James E. O'Hara, an African American state legislator, introduced companion legislation to the Blair Bill in 1886 that died in committee. African American educator and editor Charles N. Hunter convinced Blair himself to speak on the subject of education at the Negro Fair in Raleigh on November 11, 1886. In his speech, Blair proclaimed that freedom needed, quote-unquote, land and education, and that the first quality of a freeman is knowledge, for knowledge is power. Political debates over federal aid raged throughout the 1800s. Meanwhile, the state system of educational funding through taxes became highly unequal. In 1881, the General Assembly passed a bill providing property taxes for white landowners to fund white schools and from black landowners to fund black schools. Because whites made up the vast majority of landowners in North Carolina, this bill was a boon to white schools. For example, in 1886, in New Bern, per pupil spending at the local public schools was $11 per white student, but $5 per black student, said the Democratic Raleigh News and Observer. Each race should be responsible for the education of its children. Though segregation and Jim Crow continued to strengthen in the state, in 1886, the state Supreme Court found the 1881 tax law unconstitutional in a series of decisions, citing the discrepancy in public education funding based upon race. White backlash over this decision reverberated throughout the state, as shown when a local paper in New Bern said, quote, "A constitution that will not allow the white people to tax themselves for the benefit of their schools after they have contributed liberally to Negro schools is not the constitution that the white people of North Carolina want." End quote. During the gubernatorial campaign of 1900, Charles B. Aycock tapped into the racism of white North Carolinians and used it to his political advantage. Aycock, a Democrat who had been lauded as the state's education governor, ran on a platform of black voter disenfranchisement and universal education. After his electoral triumph in 1900, Aycock and the Democrats soon etched obstacles to voting into the state constitution. Indeed, Aycock was no progressive Southerner when it came to education. His intentions were directly connected to suffrage and white supremacy. According to North Carolina's Grandfather Clause, all white males whose ancestors could vote in 1867 would be allowed to vote, whether they were literate or not. Most African Americans could not satisfy such criteria, since free blacks were banned from voting in North Carolina in 1835, while newly freed people did not gain the right to vote until 1868. Moreover, any white man who could read or write by 1908 would be able to vote thereafter. Yet black men faced more difficult challenges to voting, such as the threat of white violence, even if they were literate. Thus, Aycock began advocating education for poor whites in order to ease illiterate whites' fears of disenfranchisement. The Aycock administration also changed the tax code as it related to education funding, placing a higher tax burden on African Americans, while disproportionately allocating funds towards white schools. James Y. Joyner, a staunch ally of Aycock and a North Carolina superintendent of public instruction from 1902 to 1919, traveled the state advising local districts on how to allocate education funds to favor whites. In one letter to a local superintendent, Joyner wrote, open quote, "In most places, it does not take more than 1/4 as much to run the Negro schools as it does to run the white schools for about the same number of children. The salaries paid to teachers are very probably much smaller. If quietly managed, the Negroes will give no trouble about it." End quote. The gap between black and white public education in North Carolina increased dramatically. From 1904 to 1920, annual spending per white school averaged $3,442, but only averaged $500 for black schools. School terms were longer in white-majority counties that levied local taxes than in black-majority counties. For example, in 1914, the average term for locally taxed white counties was 137 days. Compared to 120 days in black counties. Funds for rural black schools in North Carolina often went instead to rural white schools. Charles Moore, field organizer and inspector of rural schools in North Carolina at the time, wrote the State Department of Education that, thousands of dollars earmarked for black education had actually been spent to build schools, hire additional teachers, or increase the school term for whites. Funding discrepancies created daunting obstacles for African American teachers and students. Most African American teachers were women because their lack of education, plus the opportunity to make more money in industrial and agricultural labor, steered many African American men away from the profession. Even educated black women had few professional options, so many became educators, despite significant challenges. Historian Belinda Littlefield found that African American teachers in North Carolina were paid an average of $20 less per month than white teachers, regardless of education or experience. Black teachers faced much larger classroom sizes and were given highly inadequate resources compared to white teachers. According to one contemporaneous African-American teacher in North Carolina named Lola Salas, the only supplies black teachers received from the county were a broom and a bucket. Textbooks for black schools were rented by African-American parents, and they were always secondhand books from the white schools. Conditions were so poor that white Northern philanthropists, pitched by Booker T. Washington and other black Southern education leaders, began to send aid to Southern black schools. Outside influences, Rosenwald schools, and philanthropic societies. Northern white philanthropic efforts towards Southern blacks date to the Civil War and the American Missionary Association. Such groups dwindled after Reconstruction, but the legacy of Northern philanthropy was revived in 1910 when Julius Rosenwald, president of Sears, Roebuck & Company, acceded to pressure from Washington and provided matching grants to rural Southern communities that agreed to build black schools. Officially created in 1917, the Rosenwald Fund dramatically improved North Carolina's black educational facilities. The Rosenwald Fund not only supported the construction of hundreds of black schools, but also demonstrated black North Carolinians' dedication to education. By 1932, when the fund dissolved, more than 800 Rosenwald buildings stood in North Carolina, more than in any other state. Many of the female African American teachers who taught in Rosenwald buildings were trained and paid by another Northern philanthropic society, the Anna T. Jeans Fund. In addition to teaching, Jeans teachers went into the community to instruct residents in modern healthcare, child rearing, and home economics. These efforts did not go unnoticed, as Nathan Carter Newbold, the North Carolina Director of Negro Education, created in 1921, later remembered, "School superintendents, Jeans teachers, general education board agents, county training school principals, and people all seized upon the Rosenwald School as something visible, tangible, and evidence of progress in Negro education that could not be gainsaid." It probably was the missing link all agencies needed to round out a complete program for Negro schools. Difficulties remained. For instance, one student who attended a Rosenwald school in Mecklenburg County in the 1930s recalled, "When you got here in winter, it was terrible. You'd be so cold your fingers, they'd just ache like a toothache." Nevertheless, the Rosenwald Fund injected much-needed support into black education in North Carolina. The state's investment in black schools increased from $1.28 million during the 1919 through 1920 school year to $4.53 million by the 1927 through 1928 school year. Investment in white schools grew even faster, exacerbating funding discrepancies. During the same period, the value of white schools rose from $10.69 million to $50.05 million. Disparities in per pupil spending increased as well. For example, During the 1914 through 1915 school year, the state spent $2.77 per white student, which rose to $3.11 per white student in 1932. During the same period, spending per black student remained steady at just $1. African American communities used white disregard for black education as an opportunity for community cohesion and autonomy. According to historian Barry F. Malone, open quote, as blacks labored to invest time, materials, and money, the community developed a real sense of ownership and governance, end quote. Yet Malone says, surrender of this control became problematic for both races later during the integration process.